Northwestward. Thomas Trumbull said to Emmanuel Reuben in a low voice, "Where the devil have you been? I've been trying to reach you for a week." Reuben's eyes flashed behind the thick lenses of his spectacles, and his sparse beard bristled. "I was away at the Berkshires for a week. I was not aware I had to apply for permission to you for that."
"I wanted to speak to you."
"Then speak to me now. Here I am. That is, supposing you can think of something intelligent to say."
Trumbull looked about hastily. The Black Widowers had gathered for the monthly banquet at the Milano, and Trumbull had managed to arrive on time because he was the host. He said,
"Keep your voice down, for God's sake, Manny. I can't speak freely now. It's about—"
His voice dropped to a mere mouthing.
"My guest."
"Well, what about him?"
Reuben glanced in the direction of the tall, distinguished-looking elderly man who was conversing with Geoffrey Avalon in the far corner. The guest was a good 2 inches taller than Avalon, who was usually the tallest person at the gathering. Reuben, who was 10 inches shorter than Avalon, grinned.
"I think it does Jeff good to have to look up now and then," he said.
"Listen to me, will you?" said Trumbull. "I've talked to the others, and you were the only one I was really worried about, and the only one I couldn't reach."
"But what are you worried about? Get to the point."
"It's my guest. He's peculiar."
"If he's your guest,
shh. He's an interesting guy, and he's not nuts. But you may consider him peculiar, and I don't want you to mock him. You just let him be peculiar and accept it."
"How is he peculiar?"
"He has an idée fixe, if you know what that means."
Reuben looked revolted.
"Can you tell me why it's so necessary for an American with a stumbling knowledge of English to say idée fixe when the English phrase fixed idea does just as well?"
"He has a fixed idea, then. It will come out because he can't keep it in. Please don't make fun of it or of him. Please accept him on his own terms."
"This violates the whole principle of the grilling, Tom."
"It just bends it a little. I'm asking you to be polite, that's all. Everyone else has agreed."
Reuben's eyes narrowed.
"I'll try. But so help me, Tom, if this is some sort of gag, if I'm being set up for something, I'll stand on a stool if I have to, and I'll punch you right in the eye."
"There's no gag involved."
Reuben wandered over to where Mario Gonzalo was putting the finishing touches on his caricature of the guest. Not much of a caricature at that. He was turning out a Gibson man, a collar ad. Reuben looked at it, then turned to look at the guest. He said,
"You're leaving out the lines, Mario."
"Caricature," said Gonzalo, "is the art of truthful exaggeration, Manny. When a guy looks that good at his age, you don't spoil the effect by sticking in lines."
"What's his name?"
"I don't know. Tom didn't give it. He says we ought to wait for the grilling to ask." Roger Halstead ambled over, drink in hand, and said in a low voice, "Tom was looking for you all week, Manny."
"He told me, and he found me right here."
"Did he explain what he wanted?"
"He didn't explain it. He just asked me to be nice."
"Are you going to?"
"I will. Until I get the idea that this is a joke at my expense, after which—"
"No, he's serious." Henry, that quiet bit of waiter perfection, said in his soft, carrying voice, "Gentlemen, dinner is served." And they all sat down to their crab-leg cocktails. James Drake had stubbed out his cigarette, since by general vote there was to be no smoking during the actual meal, and handed the ashtray to Henry. He said, "Henry's announcement just now interrupted our guest in some comments he was making about Superman, which I'd like him to repeat if he doesn't mind." The guest nodded his head in a stately gesture of gratitude, and having finished an appreciative mouthful of veal marengo, said, "What I was saying was that Superman was a travesty of an ancient and honorable tradition. There has always been a branch of literature concerning itself with heroes, human beings of superior strength and courage. Heroes, however, should be supernormal, but not supernatural." "As a matter of fact," said Avalon in his startling baritone, "I agree. There have always been characters like Hercules, Achilles, Gilgamesh, Rustum."
"We get the idea, Jeff," said Reuben, balefully.
Avalon went on smoothly. "Even half a century ago we had the development of Conan by Robert Howard as a modern legend. These were all far stronger than we puny fellows are, but they were not godlike. They could be hurt, wounded, even killed. They usually were in the end.
In the Iliad, said Reuben, perfectly willing, as always, to start an argument, the gods could be wounded. Ares and Aphrodite were each wounded by Diomedes.
Homer can be allowed liberties, put in the guest. But compare, say, Hercules with Superman. Superman has X-ray eyes. He can fly through space without protection. He can move faster than light. None of this would be true of Hercules. But with Superman's abilities, where is the excitement? Where's the suspense? Then, too, where's the fairness? He fights off human crooks who are less to him than a ladybug would be to me. How much pride can I take in flipping a ladybug off my wrist?
Drake said, One trouble with these heroes, though, is that they're muscle-bound at the temples. Take Siegfried. If he had an atom of intelligence, he took care never to show it. For that matter, Hercules was not remarkable for the ability to think either.
On the other hand, said Halsted, Prince Valiant had brains, and so especially did Odysseus.
Rare exceptions, said Drake.
Reuben turned to the guest and said, You seem very interested in storybook heroes.
Yes, I am, said the guest quietly. It's almost an idée fixe with me.
He smiled with obvious self-deprecation.
I keep talking about them all the time, it seems. It was soon after that Henry brought on the baked Alaska.
Trumbull tapped his water glass with his spoon at about the time that Henry was carefully supplying the brandy. Trumbull had waited well past the coffee, as though reluctant to start the grilling, and even now the tinkle of metal against glass seemed less authoritative than customary.
Trumbull said, It is time we begin the grilling of our guest, and I would like to suggest that Manny Reuben do the honors.
Reuben favored Trumbull with a hard stare, then said to the guest,
Sir, it is usual to ask our guest to begin by justifying his existence, but against all custom, Tom has not introduced you by name. May I, therefore, ask you what your name is?
Certainly, said the guest. My name is Bruce Wayne.
Reuben turned immediately toward Trumbull, who made an unobtrusive but clear, quieting gesture with his hands.
Reuben took a deep breath and managed a smile.
Well, Mr. Wayne, since we were speaking of heroes, I can't resist asking you if you are ever kidded about being the comic strip hero Batman. Bruce Wayne is Batman's real name, as you probably know.
I do know, said Wayne, because I am Batman.
There was a general stir at the table at this, and even the ordinarily imperturbable Henry raised his eyebrows. Wayne was apparently accustomed to this reaction, for he sipped at his brandy without reacting.
Reuben cast another quick glance at Trumbull, then said carefully,
I suppose that, in saying this, you imply that you are in one way or another to be identified with the comic strip character, and not with something else named Batman, as, for instance, an officer's orderly in the British Army.
You're right, said Wayne. I'm referring to the comic strip character. Of course, and he smiled gently, I'm not trying to convince you I am literally the comic strip Batman, cape, bat symbol and all. As you see, I am a three-dimensional living human being, and I assure you I am aware of that. However, I inspired the existence of the comic strip character Batman.
And how did that come about? Asked Reuben.
In the past, when I was considerably younger than I am now.
How old are you now? Asked Halsted suddenly.
Wayne smiled.
Tom has told me I must answer all questions truthfully, so I will tell you, though I'd prefer not to. I am 73 years old.
Halsted said, You don't look it, Mr. Wayne. You could pass for 50.
Thank you. I try to keep fit.
Reuben said with a trace of impatience,
Would you get back to my question, Mr. Wayne? Do you want it repeated?
No, my memory manages to limp along satisfactorily.
When I was considerably younger than I am now, I was of some help to various law enforcement agencies. At that time, there was money to be had in these comic strips about heroes, and a friend of mine suggested that I serve as a model for one. Batman was invented with a great many of my characteristics and much of my history. It was, of course, distinctly romanticized,
I did not go about with a cape and have never done so, or had a helicopter of my own. But I did insist that Batman be given no supernatural powers, but be restricted to entirely human abilities. I admit they do stretch it a bit sometimes. Even the villains Batman faces, although they are invariably grotesque, are exaggerations of people with whom I had problems in the past, and whom I helped put out of circulation. Avalon said, "I see why Superman annoys you, then. There was a television Batman for 2 seasons. What about that?" I remember it well, especially Julie Newmar playing Catwoman. I would have liked to have met her as an opponent in real life. The program was played for laughs, you know, and good-natured fun. "Well," said Drake, looking about the table and carefully lighting a cigarette now that the meal was over, and cupping it in his hand in the obvious belief that that would trap the smoke, "you seem to have had an amusing life. Are you the multimillionaire that the comic strip Batman is?" "As a matter of fact," said Wayne, "I'm very well off. My house in the suburbs is elaborate, and I even have an adjoining museum. But you know, we're all human. I have my problems." "Married? Children?" asked Avalon. "No, there I also resemble my alter ego, or he resembles me. I have never been married and have no children. Those are not my problems. I have a butler who tends to my household needs, along with some other servants who are of comparatively trivial importance."
"In the comic strip," said Gonzalo, "your butler is your friend and confidant, right?"
"Well, yes." And he sighed. Reuben looked thoughtful and said, "Tell us about the museum, Mr. Wayne. What kind of museum is it? A headquarters for science and criminology?" "Oh, no. The comic strip continues successfully, but my own day as an active upholder of the law is over. My museum consists of curios. There have been a great many objects made that have been based on the Batman cartoon and his paraphernalia. I have, I believe, at least one of every single piece ever made in that fashion. Batman notepaper, large-scale models of the Batmobile, figurines of every important character in the strip, copies of every magazine issue featuring the character, cassettes of all the television shows, and so on. It pleases me to have all this. After all, I am sure the strip will survive me, and it will be the part of me that will be best remembered after my death. I don't have children to revere my memory, and I have done nothing very much in my real life to make me part of history. These evidences of my fictional life are the best I can do to bring myself a little nearer to immortality." Reuben said, "I see. Now, I'm going to ask a question that may cause you to feel a little uncomfortable, but you must answer. You said, 'Oh, for God's sake, Tom, this is a legitimate question. Why don't you let me ask it before you start jumping?'" Trumbull, looking both abashed and troubled, sank back in his chair. Reuben said, "A little while ago, Mr. Wayne, you said that you too have your problems, and almost immediately afterward, when you mentioned your butler, you looked distinctly uncomfortable. Are you having trouble with your butler?" "What are you laughing at, Tom?"
"Nothing," said Trumbull, chuckling.
Wayne said, "He's laughing because he bet me $5 that if I just answered any questions about me, and did so naturally and truthfully, the Black Widowers would have this out of me within 20 minutes, and he's won."
"I take it, then, that Tom Trumbull knows about this."
"Yes, I do," said Trumbull. "But I'm dealing myself out of this one for that reason. The rest of you handle it."
"I would suggest," interposed Avalon, "that Tom and Manny both quiet down, and that we ask Mr. Wayne to tell us his troubles with his butler."
"My butler's name," began Wayne, "is Cecil Pennyworth."
"Don't you mean Alfred Pennyworth?" put in Halstead.
"No interruptions," said Trumbull, clinking his water glass.
Wayne said, "That's all right, Tom. I don't mind being interrupted. Alfred Pennyworth was indeed my butler originally, and with his permission, his name was used in the strip. However, he was older than I, and in the course of time, he died. Characters do not necessarily age and die in comic strips, but real life is rather different, you know. My present butler is Alfred's nephew."
"Is he a worthy substitute?" asked Drake softly.
"No one could ever replace Alfred, of course, but Cecil has given satisfaction." Here Wayne frowned. "In all but one respect. And there my problem rests."
You must understand that I sometimes attend conventions that are devoted to comic strip heroes. I don't make a big issue of my being Batman, and I don't put on a cape or anything like that, although the publishers sometimes hire actors to do so. What I do is set up an exhibition of my Batman memorabilia. Sometimes my publishers set up the more conventional items for sale, not so much for the money that is taken in as for the publicity, since it keeps the thought of Batman alive in the minds of people. I have nothing to do with the commercial aspect. What I do is exhibit a selection of some of the more unusual curios that are not for sale. I allow them to be seen and studied while I give a little lecture on the subject. That has its publicity value, too. Needless to say, it is necessary to keep a sharp eye on all the exhibits. Most of them have no intrinsic value to speak of, but they are enormously valuable to me, and sometimes, I'm afraid, to the fans. While the vast majority of them wouldn't think of appropriating any of the items, there are bound to be occasional individuals who, out of a natural dishonesty or, more likely, an irresistible desire, would try to make off with one or more items. We have to watch for that. I am even the target for more desperate felons. On two different occasions, there have been attempts to break into my museum, attempts that I am glad to say were foiled by our rather sophisticated security system. I see you are smiling, Mr. Avalon, but actually my memorabilia, however trivial they might seem, could be disposed of quietly for a considerable sum of money. One item I have does, in fact, have a sizable intrinsic value. It is a Batman ring in which the bat symbol is cut out of an emerald. I was given it under circumstances that, if I may say so, reflected well on the real Batman, myself, and it has always been much dearer to me for that reason than because of the value of the emerald itself. It is the pièce de résistance of my collection, and I put it on display only very occasionally. A year or so ago, though, I had promised to appear at a convention in Minneapolis, and I did not quite feel up to going. As you see, I am getting on in age, and for all my fitness program, my health and my sense of well-being are not what they once were. I therefore asked Cecil Pennyworth to attend the convention as my substitute. On occasion, I have asked him to fill in for me, though till then not at a major convention. I had promised an interesting display, but I had to cut that to Cecil's measure. I chose small items that could all be packed systematically, so they could be quickly checked to make sure the display was intact, in a single, good-sized suitcase. I sent Cecil off with the usual unnecessary admonition to keep a close watch on everything. He called me from Minneapolis to assure me of his safe arrival, and again, a few hours later, to apprise me of the fact that an attempt had been made to switch suitcases. "And failed, I hope," I said. He assured me that he had the right suitcase and that the display was safe and intact, but he asked me if I really felt he should display the ring. You see, since I was sending only small items, I felt that I was, in a way, cheating my public, and I therefore included my ring so that at least they could see this rarest and most valuable of all my curios. I told Cecil, therefore, that he should certainly display the ring, but keep the sharpest of eyes upon it. I heard from him again 2 mornings later, when the convention was drawing to a close. He was breathless and sounded strained. "Everything is safe, Mr. Wayne," he said, "but I think I am being followed. I can duck them, though. I'm going northwest, and I'll see you soon." I said, rather alarmed, "Are you in danger?" He only said, "I must go now," and hung up. I was galvanized into activity. It's the Batman in me, I suppose. I threw off all trace of my indisposition and made ready for action. It seemed to me that I knew what was happening. Cecil was being tracked by someone intent on that suitcase, and he was not himself a strong person of the heroic mold. It seemed to him, therefore, that he ought to do the unexpected. Instead of returning to New York, he would try to elude those who were after him, and quietly head off in another direction altogether. Once he had gotten away from his pursuers, he could then return to New York in safety. What's more, I knew where he was going. I have several homes over the United States, which is the privilege of one who, like myself, is quite well off. One of my homes is a small and unobtrusive place in North Dakota, where I sometimes go when I feel the need to isolate myself from the too unbearable insinuations of the world into my private life. It made good sense to go there. No one but Cecil and me and some legal representatives knows that the house in question belongs to me. If he got there safely, he could feel secure. He knew that to indicate to me that he was going northwestward would have complete meaning to me and would mean nothing to anyone who might overhear him. That was clever. He had to hang up quickly because, I presume, he was aware of enemies in the vicinity. He had said, "I'll see you soon," by which, it seemed to me, he was begging me to go to my North Dakota home to join him. Clearly, he wanted me to take over the responsibility of defense. As I said, he was not the heroic type. He had called me in the morning, and before night fell, I was at my North Dakota house. I remember being grateful that it was early fall. I would have hated to have to go there with 2 feet of snow on the ground and the temperature 40 below. Reuben, who was listening intently, said, "I suppose that your butler, in weather like that, would have chosen some other place as a hideout. He would have told you he was going southeastward, and you would have gone to your home in Florida, if you have one." "I have a home in Georgia," said Wayne. "But you are correct otherwise. I suppose that is what he would have done. In any case, when I arrived in North Dakota, I found that Cecil was not yet there. I got in touch with the people who care for the place in my absence, and who know me only as a Mr. Smith, and they assured me that nobody, to their knowledge, had arrived. There were no signs of any very recent occupancy, so he could not have arrived and been waylaid in the house. Of course, he might have been interrupted en route. I spent the night in the house, a very wakeful night, as you can imagine, and an uncomfortable one. In the morning, when he still had not arrived, I called the police. There were no reports of any accidents to planes, trains, buses, or cars that could have possibly applied to Cecil. I decided to wait another day or so. It was possible, after all, that he might have taken a circuitous route or paused on the way, holed up, one might say, to mislead his pursuers, and would soon take up the trip again. In short, he might arrive a day late, or even 2 days late. On the third morning, however, I could wait no more. I was certain by then that something was very wrong. I called my New York home, feeling he might have left a message there, and was rather berating myself for not having made the call earlier for that purpose, or, if no message had been received, to have left the number at which I could be reached when the message came. At any rate, on the third morning I called, and it was Cecil who answered. I was thunderstruck. He had arrived on the afternoon of the day I had left. I simply said I would be home that night, and of course I was. So you see my difficulty, gentlemen. There was a short silence at the rather abrupt ending to the story, and then Reuben said, "I take it that Cecil was perfectly safe and sound." "Oh, yes, indeed. I asked him about the pursuers, and he smiled faintly and said, 'I believe I eluded them, Mr. Wayne. Or I may even have been entirely mistaken, and they did not really exist. At least, I wasn't bothered at all on my way home.'"
"So that he got home safely?"
"Yes, Mr. Reuben."
"And the exhibition curios were intact?"
"Entirely."
"Even the ring, Mr. Wayne?"
"Absolutely." Reuben threw himself back in the chair with an annoyed expression on his face.
"Then no, I don't see your difficulty."
"But why did he tell me he was going northwestward? He told me that distinctly. There is no question of my having misheard." Halstead said, "Well, he thought he was being followed, so he told you he was going to the North Dakota place. Then he decided that either he had gotten away from the pursuers or that they didn't exist, and he thereupon switched his plans and went straight to New York without having time to call you again and warn you of that." "Don't you think, in that case," said Wayne, with some heat, "he might have apologized to me? After all, he had misled me, sent me on an unnecessary chase into North Dakota, subjected me to a little over 2 days of uncertainty, during which I not only feared for my collection, but also felt that he might be lying dead or badly injured somewhere. All this was the result of his having told me falsely that he was heading northwestward. And then, having arrived in New York, he might have known, since I wasn't home, that I had flown to the North Dakota house to be with him. And he might have had the kindness to call me there and tell me he was safe. He knew the North Dakota number, but he didn't call me, and he didn't apologize to me or excuse himself when I got home."
"Are you sure he knew that you were in North Dakota?" asked Halstead.
"Of course I'm sure he knew. For one thing, I told him. I had to account for the fact that I had been away from home for 3 days. I said, "Sorry I wasn't home when you arrived, Cecil. I had to make a quick and unexpected trip to North Dakota." It would have taken a heart of forged steel not to have winced at that, and not to have begun apologizing, but it didn't seem to bother him at all. There was another pause at this point, and then Avalon cleared his throat in a deep rumble and said, "Mr. Wayne, you know your butler better than any of us do. How do you account for this behavior?" "The logical feeling is that it was just callousness," said Wayne. "But I don't know him as a callous man. I have evolved the following thought, though. What if he had been tempted by the ring and the other curios himself? What if it was his plan to dispose of them for his own benefit? He could tell me that he was being pursued, and that would send me off on my foolish mission to North Dakota so that he would have a period of time to put away his ill-gotten gains somewhere and pretend he had been robbed. See?" Reuben said, "Do you know Cecil to be a dishonest man?" "I wouldn't have said so, but anyone can yield to temptation." "Granted. But if he did, he resisted. You have everything. He didn't steal anything." "That's true. But his telling me he was going northwestward and then never explaining why he had changed his mind tells me that he was up to skullduggery. Just because he was too faint-hearted to go through with it this time doesn't excuse him. He might be bolder the next time." Reuben said, "Have you asked him to explain the northwestward business?" Wayne hesitated. "I don't like to. Suppose there is some explanation. The fact that I would ask him about it would indicate that I didn't trust him, and that would spoil our relationship. My having waited so long makes it worse. If I ask now, it would mean I have brooded about it all year, and I'm sure he would resign in resentment. On the other hand, I can't think what explanation he might have, and my not asking him leaves me unable to relax in his presence. I find I am always keyed up and waiting for him to try again." Reuben said, "Then it seems that if you don't ask him, but convince yourself he's guilty, your relationship is ruined. And if you do ask him, and he convinces you he's innocent, your relationship is ruined. What if you don't ask him, but convince yourself he is innocent?" "That would be fine," said Wayne. "But how? I would love to do so. When I think of my long and close association with Alfred Pennyworth, Cecil's uncle, I feel I owe something to the nephew. But I must have an explanation, and I don't dare to ask for it." Drake said, "Since Tom Trumbull knows about all this, what do you say about it, Tom?" Wayne interposed. "Tom says I should forget all about it." Trumbull said, "That's right. Cecil might have been so ashamed of his needless panic that he just can't talk about it." "But he did talk about it," said Wayne heatedly. "He casually admitted that he might have been mistaken about being pursued, and did so as soon as I got home. Why didn't he apologize to me and express regret for the trouble he had put me to?"
"Maybe that's what he can't talk about," said Trumbull.
"Ridiculous. What do I do, wait for a deathbed confession? He's 22 years younger than I am, and he'll outlive me."
"Then," said Avalon, "if we're to clear the air between you, we must find some natural explanation that would account for his having told you he was heading northwestward, and that would also account for his having failed to express regret over the trouble he put you to."
"Exactly," said Wayne. "But to explain both at once is impossible. I defy you to."
The silence that followed endured for quite a while until Reuben said, "And you won't accept embarrassment as an explanation for his failure to express regret?"
"Of course not."
"And you won't ask him?"
"No, I won't," said Wayne, biting off the remark with decision.
"And you find having him in your employ under present conditions is wearisome and nerve-wracking?"
"Yes, I do."
"But you don't want to fire him either?"
"No. For old Alfred's sake, I don't."
"In that case," said Reuben gloomily, "you have painted yourself into a corner, Mr. Wayne. I don't see how you can get out of it."
"I still say," growled Trumbull, "that you ought to forget about it, Bruce. Pretend it never happened."
"That's more than I can do," said Wayne, frowning.
"Then Manny is right," said Trumbull. "You can't get out of the hole you're in."
Reuben looked about the table.
"Tom and I say Wayne can't get out of this impasse. What about the rest of you?"
Avalon said, "What of a third party?"
"No," said Wayne instantly. "I won't have anyone else discussing this with Cecil. This is strictly between him and me." Avalon shook his head.
Then I'm stuck, too.
It would appear, said Reuben, looking about the table, that none of the Black Widowers can help you.
None of the Black Widowers seated at the table, said Gonzalo. But we haven't asked Henry yet. He's our waiter, Mr. Wayne, and you'd be surprised at his ability to work things out. Henry?
Yes, Mr. Gonzalo, said Henry, from his quiet post at the sideboard.
You heard everything. What do you think Mr. Wayne ought to do?
I agree with Mr. Trumbull, sir. I think that Mr. Wayne should forget the matter.
Wayne rolled his eyes upward and shook his head firmly.
However, Henry went on, I have a specific reason for suggesting it, one that perhaps Mr. Wayne will agree with.
Good, said Gonzalo. What is it, Henry?
I couldn't help but notice, sir, that all of you, in referring to what Mr. Pennyworth said on the phone, mentioned that he said he was going northwestward. That, however, isn't quite so. When Mr. Wayne first mentioned the phone conversation, he quoted Mr. Pennyworth as saying, I'm going northwest. Is that correct?
Wayne said, Yes, as a matter of fact, that is what he said, but does it matter? What is the difference between northwestward and northwest?
A huge difference, Mr. Wayne. To go northwestward can only mean traveling in a particular direction, but to go northwest need not mean that at all.
Of course it needs to mean that.
No, sir, I beg your pardon, Mr. Wayne, but to go northwest could mean one's intention to take a plane belonging to Northwest Airlines, one of our larger plane lines.
The pause that followed was electric. Then Wayne whispered,
Good Lord.
Yes, sir, and in that case everything explains itself. Mr. Pennyworth may have been mistaken about being followed, but even if he thought he was not sufficiently worried over the situation to follow any circuitous route. He told you he was taking a Northwest airplane, speaking of the matter elliptically, as many people do, and assuming you would understand. Despite the name of the plane line, which may have been more accurate at its start, Northwest Airlines serves the United States generally, and you can take one of its planes from Minneapolis to New York, traveling eastward. I'm sure that but for the coincidence that you had a home in North Dakota, you might have interpreted Mr. Pennyworth's remark correctly. Mr. Pennyworth, under the impression he had told you he was flying to New York, said he would see you soon, meaning in New York. And he hung up suddenly, probably because his flight announced that it was ready for boarding.
Good Lord, said Wayne again.
Exactly, sir. Then when Mr. Pennyworth got home and found you had been to North Dakota, he could honestly see no connection between that and anything he might have done, so that it never occurred to him to apologize for his actions. He couldn't have asked you why you had gone to North Dakota. As a servant, it wasn't his place to. Had you explained of your own accord, he would have understood the confusion and would undoubtedly have apologized for contributing to it. But you remained silent.
Good Lord, said Wayne a third time.
Then, energetically, I have spent over a year making myself miserable over nothing at all. There's no question about it. Batman has made a terrible mistake.
Batman, said Henry, has, as you yourself have pointed out, the great advantage and the occasional disadvantage of being only human.